Hello and welcome to another episode of Lost in Science. We are lost. We are in science. We are doing all of the ticking all the boxes, I guess. Joining me with her headphones with cat ears is Lyndon. How are you, Lyndon?
I'm well, thanks, Chris. And certainly not at all embarrassed that you've just told everybody that I'm wearing cat ear headphones that I've borrowed from my toddler. Wow. How are you going?
I'm good. They're very stylish, I gotta say.
Yeah. I keep thinking I should buy some grown-up headphones, but these ones, I don't know. I like them. I think I'm nailing them. And every now and again, if I bring in an animal story, it feels like they're on theme, which I appreciate as well.
Right. We're just lucky you had the same head size as your toddler. But anyway. Yeah.
There's another story about that, but we won't go there today.
Speaking of stories, have you got something to infotain us with today?
I do, but it's not about cats.
Okay.
So just measure your expectations there. Actually, it's an interview that I wanted to bring to the table today. This is a discussion with an early career researcher. It's so valuable, I think, to share the stories and experiences of people who are getting into research, people who have come from different places, different backgrounds. And this week, we're lucky enough to be joined by Grace. Sethanan. She was born and raised in Thailand, and she went over and did a PhD in Canada. And now she's joined the Australian research community, where she works at the University of Melbourne, and she is an earthquake researcher. Oh. So she is doing research that's funded by Geoscience Australia to explore earthquake hazards, essentially. She's building this amazing map of particular fault lines all across the country. And yeah, we have a really good chat about the earthquake risks that exist in Australia and how you can go about exploring them. I checked the Geoscience Australia website just before we started chatting, and there have been 6 earthquakes in the last 7 days.
Seriously?
Yeah, across Australia. So many people think, we don't get any earthquakes because we don't have any big, you know, continental level fault lines, but we do have fault lines within the continent. And Grace's research is using some pretty cool techniques to try to piece those together, which can then inform building codes and hazard management planning into the future, particularly in South Australia.
Great, great. Yeah, you're right. I mean, people don't think of Australia as being particularly earthquake prone, but as you said, there are a lot of earthquakes. I'm sure we've all experienced them here and there. It was 1989, the Newcastle earthquake.
Mm-hmm. There was that 2021, I think the Woods Hole earthquake over near Mansfield. Remember where people felt that, even in Melbourne, that Betty's Burgers, that there were some buildings that collapsed and those kinds of things.
Yeah.
The earthquakes that were recorded over the last 7 days across Australia, most of those were quite small, no more than two units of magnitude? Magnitude 2.5. There are a couple of 2.5s in South Australia. That doesn't mean there can't be a bigger one, and doesn't mean those smaller ones, I don't know, can't have some impact. So it was a really nice chat that I had with Grace, and I enjoyed the opportunity to hear her passion for earthquakes and earthquake science globally, and to hear how she's applying that passion in Australia. So that's what I'm bringing this week.
Great.
What about you, Chris?
I'll say whatever rocks you there. What's rocks your world? I've got some, it's actually a couple of weeks old now. I don't know how we missed it. One of the big prizes, science awards in Australia. We'd make a big deal out of things like, I think, the Eureka Prizes and the Nobel Prizes, of course, which are overseas, and the Ig Nobels, not to mention. But the Prime Minister's Prizes are the kind of the official kind of glossy prizes in Australia. I was trying to think, you know, we talk about the comparisons. I always like to call the Eurekas like the Logies of science, because I think they're that kind of local kind of award thing. But there is a real equivalent for the Prime Minister's Prizes, you know, something that's given out by, as the name suggests, the government to distinguished scientists. There's not really an equivalent there.
Is there an Australian film cat? No.
No, I don't think
that doesn't
People
work.
Say things like the Oscars of science, but like the you know, the Nobel Prizes are really the equivalent of the Oscars in terms of science, I think. You know, I mean, I think Nobel Prizes are a step above Oscars. But you think of like, I mean, to me, like, if you look at the trio of awards that humans can get, it's like the Nobel Prize, an Oscar, and an Olympic gold medal. Basically, if you get those three, those are the top.
You can just lie down for the rest of your life.
Exactly. That's what you've got to aim for. But
and how many people do you know have got all three of those?
Not many. I mean, there are people who've gotten like the first two. Like, and I'm sure they've been shared. Like, it's got to be like someone who's got like an Oscar and a gold medal, surely. But I mean, like Al Gore famously got a Nobel Peace Prize for his work with climate change, and his movie got a Oscar as well.
Yeah.
So he is a double threat, I suppose.
He needs to get into some of those sports that you can do regardless of your age, like shooting or something. And then maybe he could get the triple. But we're not going to be talking about that today.
No,
we're talking about people who've won this year's Australian Prime Minister's Prizes for Science, which have no equivalent.
That's right. That's right. So we're going to be, we'll talk a bit about the main winner, because there's one particular titular prize, but then, a lot of other people were acknowledged as well. So we'll give them all a bit of a shout out. So, yep, stay tuned for that and on with the show. Okay, yes, you are listening to Lost in Science, and we are talking about the Prime Minister's Prizes for Science, which were awarded at the start of November. These are the annual awards where the Prime Minister, and particularly, I guess, the Minister for Science, essentially, hands out a bunch of medals to distinguished scientists around the country.
Is that how they're picked, Chris? Do you know how they're selected? Is there a panel, or is it the PM and the Minister for Science and the Chief Scientist sitting around just picking names?
That's a very good question. I don't actually know. What the process, that's, you know, something that we should perhaps do some research into, I guess. I mean, it'd be new, you know, with our politicians, it's like, there's like, you know, the captain's picks and this sort of thing. So it'd be good to think that Albanese has a favourite scientist.
You'd like to think so. Mm. And the winner this year, you know, did contribute a lot globally. So possibly they were on the Prime Minister's mind, and that helped their pick, but they must nominate themselves as well. It's not just it's not a pull out of the air. They must get nominated, right?
It's not, probably. There'll be a process. But you're right. It's the main winner this year has had an international impact. And often that's the case with these winners. They're people who are kind of reach a certain level of distinguishment, I suppose, or impact in their careers, and are acknowledged for that purpose. So this year's winner is perhaps best known for work related to everybody's favourite, COVID-19, having a bit of a global impact, and not the only person to have been recognised in such a way. Professor Eddie Holmes from Sydney was, I believe, might have been 2021 or something, was one of the first people to be involved in the sequencing or the analysis of the SARS-CoV-2 virus in the early stages, and that stage of virology, and was honoured by a Prime Minister's Prizes in the early days of the COVID pandemic. Despite all the conspiracy theorists thinking that he was behind it all. But this particular one, I found, look, it's quite interesting. So this is, the winner this year is distinguished Professor Lidia Morawska from the Queensland University of Technology, Polish origin, working in Queensland, as I said. And her work is basically on air quality. Things that float around in the air, but also just air quality in general. So not just like particles like viruses and the like that can cause health impacts, of which there are many different things that can cause health impacts, but you know, even things like the gases in the air, like, you know, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, these sort of things all have an impact on our health and our performance, I guess.
To me, well, her research is when she set up her lab at QUT, when she moved to Australia, what was it, over 20 years ago, she started looking at really ultra-fine particles, didn't she? Teeny tiny little particles that exist in the atmosphere, measuring them outside, measuring them inside, and trying to understand air quality through those particles and plenty of other ones as well.
Yeah, but she actually got her start working on radon, you know, the radioactive gas that is a danger, I suppose, in some buildings and some old buildings and that sort of thing. So that's more the gas stage, I guess. But yeah, as you said, looking at ultrafine particles, those sort of things, various range of things. And she was behind a move in the in about July, mid-2020, to get the World Health Organization to acknowledge that the SARS-CoV-2 virus was actually airborne. Because I don't know how you remember, but for quite a few months there, everyone was sterilizing their groceries and that sort of thing. We had that 1.5 meter rule of you have to stand apart, which there are still circles on the floors of shops and chemists and that sort of thing. Don't stand more than 1.5 meters apart. And her work, along with 238 other scientists she gathered together from around the world, basically argued that no, this was the virus existed as an aerosol. It could persist in the air for a long time, and the distance of the 1.5 meters, which was considered, you know, basically how far a virus could spread in droplets, but people are coughing out. That was an out-of-date notion, and instead we need to be aware that just sharing the airspace with someone is the real risk, and that it was all about getting better ventilation, masks, of course, but yeah, primarily about improving ventilation and that sort of thing to control transmission. So yeah, a big shift, I guess, and acknowledge it. I think we all remember, you know, the declaration that the virus was in aerosols, but you know, whether it changed things markedly, because as I said, we still had those 1.5 meter rules and things, and sometimes that health advice can be slow to shift. But yeah, it was a big change in, I guess, the awareness of how that the virus was spread and how it could be managed.
I do. It's really great to see the distinguished professor recognized in this way for this work and the work that you did. As you said, in pulling all of those researchers globally together, she wrote that letter. The letter was published. And then I think the next day, the World Health Organization updated their guidelines. She was listed as one of Time's 100 influential people in the world in 2021, which is awesome. And it's also great to see that her campaigning, or this platform that she's now been given, will hopefully continue that conversation about air quality. You know, we don't talk about COVID so much anymore, even though it's still very present. But, you know, as Lydia has said in some of her interviews, we don't have any indoor air quality standards. We spend so much of our time inside, but there's no standards that exist or guidelines that exist for indoor air quality.
Yeah, there have been changes made since the COVID era to construction codes, like, you know, standards for, I guess, for newer buildings. Whether they're being adhered to is another matter. And
in terms of ventilation, you mean?
Yeah, yeah. And the kind of things that we're looking at, as I said, it's not just about, I mean, obviously, when you look about a particular virus, you can focus on that, but it's about other things like the level of things like carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide in the room. And these things can be measured. They're fairly easy to measure, and they're quite high in indoor environments.
Yes.
And humans don't function well at high levels of carbon dioxide, or especially carbon monoxide. And it's just interesting that, as you said, yeah, there aren't regulations around these things, and there is a shift to improve them, but we're still living with kind of old, outdated notions of, you know, crack a window if you can, but don't if it's too cold outside.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, isn't it, to think about how you balance the air quality with the insulation. Do you know what I mean? You want to keep warmth in, or you want to keep cool air in if it's really hot outside, but you also need to make sure that the air is healthy. And that, like, that's a tricky combo, and it's a combo that a lot of our houses, a lot of our buildings aren't designed for.
Yeah, well, apparently it's, yeah, as you said, it's a lot of things are not designed for that. There's kind of, I guess, the tropical architecture approach of having very wide open buildings with the air constantly flowing through. The standard approach, which will just be to like crack a window kind of thing, doesn't make a huge difference to the air quality. That there are newer ventilation systems that make a bigger difference. So that possibly comes at the cost of more energy expenditure and that sort of thing. So there is going to be a downside to that too. But yeah, you're right. There's a lot of factors. And I guess raise that awareness of it's important is the main thing.
Yeah, and great to have somebody in Australia being recognised for the decades and decades of work she's done in that space. A quick shout out as well to the inaugural winner of the Prime Minister's Prize for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Knowledge Systems. This is the first time that prize has been awarded at the Prime Minister's Prize for Science. And that was given to Professor Michael Ware, who's a Malgana man. And he was recognised for the work that he has done in Indigenous sea cucumber fishery work. So he has he's based at Murdoch University, and he's developed this company. It's called Tidal Moon, I think, where he has regenerated this practice of sea cucumber fishing that was done in pre-colonial times, and now he's built this company up to be a viable commercial fishery where sea cucumbers are being harvested in Western Australia and being sold to the overseas market. And so it's wonderful that this sort of knowledge, I think that traditional knowledge, is being appreciated in these, we're not calling them the Oscars of Australian science, we're calling them some other very distinguished collection of prizes, and to have traditional knowledge recognised in that way, I think is a really wonderful thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I was amused when they said in their description, they said the Tidal Moon is Australia's first Indigenous-owned and led sea cucumber fishery. I mean, the first perhaps for since colonisation, because there were fisheries like hundreds of years there. But anyway, the traditional trades with the Macassan people from Indonesia, I believe it was. But yeah, good to see that recognised. And like I said, good to see the Indigenous ways of knowing being acknowledged there. And particularly when we are facing threats to marine ecosystems, that more sustainable fisheries are being developed in this way.
I think we're lost.
We're not lost.
Not even any short-range radio signals yet?
Except for a single, very powerful radio emission.
Of course, a transmitter of that sort isn't exactly standard equipment.
The science and technology must be absolutely mind-boggling.
Of course, that's mostly on the theoretical side.
What so far? Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you're listening to Lost in Science.
Welcome back. You're listening to Lost in Science, and I have with me here Grace. Grace Sethanan is a researcher at the University of Melbourne School of Geography, Earth and Atmospheric Sciences. Grace, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me today, Lyndon.
Now, your work is looking at earthquakes, as I understand it. You've been exploring earthquakes in different parts around the world, but your current research is looking at earthquakes in Australia. Can you tell us a bit more about the earthquakes that we have in Australia and what makes them different or similar to other earthquakes that we get around the world?
Yes. So earthquakes in Australia is unique, I would say, because Australia, we're in a stable crust, so we're far away from those plate boundaries, but we do get earthquakes every now and then. And so it's very puzzling, like, how does these earthquakes in Australia occur? We see in the landscape throughout Australia that there are faults, which is the fractures in the ground where when two sides moves, it generates earthquake. So we have these evidence in the landscape that these mountain ridges, these linear valleys that we know probably is a fault. And so we know there is earthquakes throughout the history of Australia, but we don't actually have so much information about how big it is or how often they occur. And so that's why, like, me and the team in our university, and we work closely with Geoscience Australia, we're trying to map these faults around Australia to actually quantify the understanding of, oh, if this earthquake occurred on this fault in the landscape, we can expect a magnitude 4, for example, or 5 or 6, and that information will go into an earthquake hazard assessment model that eventually feeds into our building codes, and that's what makes our community more resilient.
Mm-hmm. When you're looking for this evidence of previous earthquakes, how do you look for those? Is that you driving out to particular parts around the country and yeah. looking to see if rocks have moved? Or are you looking at satellite mm-hmm. images? Are you looking at small magnetic changes? What kind of data goes into hopefully building yeah. up a map like this?
Yeah, and in the first step, we use satellite imagery. And a lot of the work is done in the office before we go into the field and verify stuff. So we use topography data, and it gives us the elevation throughout each area. And what's really cool is now we have this technology. Well, I think it's been there for a couple of years and decades now. It's called LIDAR or laser scanning. And so when you releases those laser pulses from an airplane or a drone, for example, it can actually really penetrate to the ground. And you have a very, very high resolution topography data of the ground, and it can go to 1 meter resolution per pixel or 50 centimeter.
Whoa.
Which is, yeah, the data set that I'm working right now in South Australia has, in certain areas, has a resolution of 50 centimeters. So I'm in the office, but I can see the ground to a resolution of 50 centimeters. And those topography data is what I'm using to map any potential faults that I see in the imagery, and then I go into the field and verify whether what I've mapped in my office, can I actually see them in real life.
So what does a potential fault look like then in the satellite imagery and then mm-hmm. in the field? How do you know that you've got
yeah.
it right?
So a lot of times we're looking at lineaments, like straight lines. Sometimes the hills in the mountains that we see around us could be dissected and eroded, curvy. But a lot of times the fault don't really, they rupture and cut through all of that irregularity topography. That's why we see a lot of lineaments in the map that might be an indicator of a fault that can generate earthquakes.
So these are straight lines across mm-hmm. landscapes that
yes.
seem a little bit like they are a fault or that they have caused an earthquake.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other like features that we can look at as well. For example, sometimes we might not see any topography, but we saw two channels, two river streams, but creates a kink. So
oh.
it's like a zigzag that when we see multiple streams doing the same thing in a straight kind of in the same orientation, we would suspect that, how does that river suddenly does an S shape in multiple streams next to each other? So we suspect that that might be caused to two sides of the ground shifted.
Mm-hmm.
And what could cause that shift? Probably an earthquake, because we might see other faults nearby as well. Yeah.
Does your technique give us any information about the timing of these earthquakes?
That's a really great question. So the mapping can also give us a relative sense of time. So when we map the faults, what we also want to map is what are the geologic units next to those faults? Because if I map a fault and the geologic units on both sides is very, very old, and old in a geologic time scale could be 100 million years, 2 million years, that might not be such an important feature to consider for the building code. But if I'm mapping a fault feature and I know that the sediments on both sides is very young, and young in the sense is 10,000 years, for example, an alluvial fan that was deposited 10,000 years ago. That's considered very young in a geologic timescale and is considered young in the sense that we need this information of when this earthquake occurred for the building codes that is important for the infrastructure in our community. And so like when, after we map that, we have to go in the field and maybe collect the samples next to that fault or close to that fault to actually get the age.
This map that you're working on, how far through it are you? Have you managed to identify any particular hotspots or potential hotspots for these potential regions of earthquakes that occur in relatively young areas that might have an impact on our building and our planning in the future?
So my research right now, I'm working in Adelaide, and I would say it is a hot spot, but not to alarm the community. And I say hot spot because there is a well-known fault that runs through Adelaide CBD. It's a fault that created the hills that Adelaide CBD Plateau is built on. So the city is on a fault scarp.
Really?
A landscape
Did not know
that, is filled by a fault. Yes.
don't have that in the Adelaide tourism advertisements.
Yeah. So we know that the landscape is built by earthquakes. And we're working closely with stakeholders in Adelaide, so the South Australia Geological Survey, Department of Infrastructure and Transport, to work together to develop this updated fault map so that any infrastructures that is going to happen in Adelaide, we have the best understanding of what the earthquake could be.
Oh, that's so valuable. After Adelaide, where do you think you'll be looking to next?
So my next grand project is to collaborate with my colleagues at the uni to expand actually nationwide. So it might not be a targeted study, but I'm working on developing a 3D fault model for Australian, like statewide. So taking what I understand from South Australia, or collaborating with my colleagues in mapping faults in Victoria or the Eyre Peninsula side or Queensland, when we have this better understanding of these local areas of the faults, we can build this nationwide 3D fault model so that any stakeholder, any researcher, like anyone who wants to use this database can take this digestible data and use it in their research or designs for infrastructure right away. So I'm trying to create this streamlined process where I want to make all of this data like updated and then as digestible and transferable as we can.
That sounds like an excellent mission. Maybe if you have to do a lot of visiting of sites to kind of validate your desk research, I can imagine that that would take a lot of time and involve a lot of excellent road trips.
Yes. And
now,
trenching,
Grace,
as well.
And what, sorry?
Trenching?
Trenching, what is that?
Trenching is when we dig the ground. So this is part of a very fun aspect in my job where we actually get to go in the field and get dirty. So a trench is when we identified a fault. We really want to know how many earthquakes has that fault hosted. We need to actually expose the ground because we want to see the sediments that are buried beneath the ground and see how much those layers have moved. So we dig probably like a 30 meter long trench, 2 meter wide, around 2 meters deep. And then we draw sketches of the layers that we see.
Okay. Well, now the road trip sounds even more fun and a bit of creativity as well. That sounds great. I can
I
see
love
that.
My
that
job.
Yeah, that sounds like a real highlight. Now, before I let you go, Grace, I wanted to hear a bit about how you got into this job that you love so much. You completed a PhD in Canada. Is that
Yes.
correct? Did you know that earthquakes is what you always wanted to explore?
Oh
Tell
my
us a bit
gosh.
about your career to date.
Yeah. It didn't came to me like waking up one day and, oh, I know I like earthquakes. It's very gradual. Like, since I'm born and raised in Thailand, so in my high school I had the opportunity to do a project about the tsunami that hit Thailand in 2004. And that kind of slowly got me into geology, or understanding how tsunami works, how earthquakes generate tsunami. And when I got into my undergrad, I did my honors in earthquakes again. And everything like naturally kind of led me to this science, this earthquake science aspect. And I enjoy doing so much, and I can see the impact that it makes to the community. And I think that's how I continue my passion in learning about this natural hazard, because I think it's fascinating. And when you look at the mountains, when I go to road trips with my friends and I look at the mountains or any linear landscape, my mind would be like, oh, I think that's caused by this earthquake, and oh, how is this going to impact us? So it's kind of having that lens of looking at the landscape that I enjoy learning about it and the earth processes. Yeah, I think that's what shaped me to be Grace today.
Well, we are very grateful that that has shaped you, and thank you so much for sharing your passion with us today. We've been joined by Dr. Grace Setanan. Thanks so much for being with us today on Lost in Science.
Thank you, Lyndon.
And that is all we have time for this week on Lost in Science. Thank you for joining us in Getting Lost. If you have any questions or suggestions for the team, get in touch with us by email. We are lostinsci@gmail.com. You can send cheap tweets to us at lostinscience1 on Twitter, or you can find us on the ubiquitous Facebook. Lost in Science is recorded at the studios of 3CR in Melbourne on the land of the Kulin Nation and is broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find a podcast version of the show on 3cr.org.au, or you can tune in the way you did this week when we return in our usual time slot to get
Lost in Science!
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.